Feel around all you want.
I need toilet paper, toilet paper, toilet paper. There's nothing to
So I wanted to start off with a little humor because the coronavirus has been really rough for us all for this last year. This is Chris. The show is the Peace and Justice Program. We are on every Friday with you with rotating hosts. And I'm very happy to be with you today. I would like to start off with an impressive person that has meant a lot to me, a stranger who made a big difference in my life, my ability to stay calm, stay informed, and get through the last almost year of the coronavirus. And back at the beginning, there wasn't a lot of information about the coronavirus. And so this is a person who is very well informed on data. But just to let you know that recently, unmasked citizens shut down the city council meeting in Chico. The governor faces a recall, mainly about his handling of corona. The deaths of 61,083 Californians are very underappreciated. 181 people have died in Butte County. That number may have gone up. With no recognition, as this virus has been with us for 13 months. Today we'll be looking at numbers, looking to understand the last year, which many of us want to put behind us, I know. But this is an important time to just sort of look at it all. So on the phone with me today, I have Christian Hammond. Christian Hammond is a third-generation Chico native, software developer, and the founder of Beanbag, a software company in the Bay Area, where he builds products used by companies around the world. He's also the creator of the unofficial Butte County COVID-19 dashboard, a volunteer project he started in May of last year, 2020, to help track, understand, and report on the spread of COVID-19 cases in our area. When not focused on work, he enjoys macro photography, old school video games, and mentoring up-and-coming computer science students. Welcome, Christian Hammond, to the Peace and Justice Program.
Chris, thanks for having me here.
Yeah, I appreciate you, making time in your busy day for us. So I'd like to start at the beginning of this. Why did you start providing data last year, and what was it like in those early days?
So a year ago was a very different time. We didn't really know much about the virus, and we didn't really have a lot of information to work from. And if you remember, we still thought this was primarily a surface transmission virus. Counties were still struggling to figure out, like, how many people who are sick are actually sick with COVID, how many deaths are attributed to that, and we just didn't have a lot of data. And so a year ago, probably about 1 month and a couple of weeks ago, Santa Clara County, which is actually where I live in the Bay Area, was hit with COVID, the first case in California. And everyone here panicked. We shut down quickly, and the county began to provide a lot of data, dashboards and daily news updates and stuff. And when cases started to work its way up Northern California, up to Chico, where I'm from and where my family is from, I started looking for that same sort of data. And there wasn't a lot of information yet. And pretty much all we had was a couple of pieces of state data, and we had the Butte County dashboard. And the dashboard provides some good information, but it was only a snapshot of the current day. So this all kind of started, my project kind of started when I decided to like start tracking the information in a spreadsheet every day with the goal of seeing like, well, how are the cases kind of evolving over time? And I started sharing that with friends and family. And eventually I was like, it's probably time to go and make this a little bit easier for people to access. So I don't have to like email stuff around to people. And I built the dashboard. And I thought, well, maybe let's get a couple of eyes on the dashboard. It might be useful to some people out there. There might be 20 or 30 people who want to see this every day. So I started posting on Facebook and Twitter. And a year later, it's ballooned up to thousands of daily viewers, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah, and that's because it's so well formulated. It's so well laid out. It's so comprehensive and digestible. And the ER did an article about you last July 25th and talked about this formula that you have. And I wish the county could have done a better job, but I'm so grateful that you stepped into the void. And I hear that you spend 3 hours a day compiling and presenting the context of the data. Can you tell us a little bit about your process and why you prioritized the information you did?
Sure. So it fluctuates. Sometimes it's as little as an hour, sometimes as much as 5 or 6 hours. But what I do every day is I go and check a variety of data sources. I catalog as much as I can in a spreadsheet. As a software developer, I have written software that automates most of this at this point. So I have data coming down from the Butte County dashboard, from various state dashboards, state data feeds and spreadsheets. So most of it gets compiled automatically, but I still go through and check like every single school dashboard every day. I check vaccine dashboards every day. And so I spend some time compiling all that, usually about an hour before the report goes out. And then once I have that, and once Butte County updates their dashboard, I pull that information in, and I start writing a report. And this process takes probably most of the time. I post on both Facebook and Twitter, and those are very different mediums for posting information. You know, with Twitter, you're kind of limited in, you know, per tweet, so you end up writing a whole bunch of tweets and trying to make everything fit. On Facebook, it's a little bit more freeform, a little bit easier to do. But I spend time trying to write all that, and I try to make sense of the data. This is, I think, an area that took the most thinking. Like, how do I take these numbers and all this various stuff that's kind of being announced in the news or shown on dashboards online? How do I like make it digestible? And that's still like an ongoing process. It's figuring out what's the right way to do this. So I try to provide the data, and I try to explain the data. And then there's Q&A typically in the comments, where if someone's curious about something, I go into it as much as I can.
Mm. So much work. And there's also the issue of how the data varies from source to source. I've just been mm-hmm. following the New York Times and Cal Matters, and you know, I'm not really sure what's going on in the world, but I really appreciate graphs and other visuals that you have that on your website, and that really helped me to understand things better. That's an important part of that. So it appears right now, from what you said, that three people have died of COVID in this week, and 10 over the last 30 days, and in the beginning of the pandemic, those numbers would have made the front page of the paper, but now they're pretty much ignored. You've watched the toll as it rose during the pandemic. Did you ever feel panicked or, you know, because you're so deep into it? I know you make little comments oftentimes at the end, well, we need to be vaccinating more people, or, mm-hmm. you know. How has it been for you psychologically during this roller coaster?
Honestly, it's really helped me. Hmm. Having the ability to kind of do something that informs other people and hopefully keeps other people safe has kind of helped me psychologically. When we had the campfire a few years ago, I felt really helpless.
Yeah.
I went up to Chico and I bought, like, I don't know, several hundred packs of hand warmers and handed them out to people in the camp. And that was, like, all I knew to do. I didn't really know what else to do. So when this happened, I thought, like, okay, you know, this is something where I can kind of apply the skills that I have to informing other people. And I've never been worried about myself during the pandemic. I'm pretty fortunate in that, like, I can easily work from home. I don't really have to go out anywhere. There's a lot of grocery delivery services and stuff in my area. And so I thought, well, I'm okay, but I'm really worried about people back home. And the fact that I've been able to keep them informed and, you know, be able to tell them, like, okay, well, cases seem to be spiking, maybe, like, don't go anywhere for a bit, or, like, it seems like things are getting better, like, you can probably breathe again. That has been helpful for me. It just takes a lot of worry off of my shoulders.
Yeah, it must be hard when your parents are up here and they're a little older than you, obviously. But you report that the greatest number of COVID cases overall are in the 18 to 24-year-old group. And at a certain point, it seemed like the contact tracing sort of wasn't working as well anymore. And we never really had a very effective mask mandate here in Butte County. And certainly social distancing, you would see in young people walking around downtown that they weren't doing that either.
Right.
And you started off talking about Santa Clara County, and I was wondering if you could just reflect on our county as opposed to other counties where there was better compliance.
Well, that's been really interesting to watch. So when Santa Clara County shut down, like, people pretty much universally were in favor of it. Part of it might be there's a lot of people here who are really following the news in China, because the Bay Area has, like, a pretty close relationship with China, a lot of travel back and forth.
Mm.
But I think just the fact that we had a case here when it was still a new virus really scared us. And so people really quickly adopted social distancing and mask mandates because it was this traumatic thing. Like, there's this scary virus we know nothing about, and it's here. But I think a lot of other places in Butte County, I believe is one of these, didn't have that initial fear because it took so long for cases to really start to develop there. There were a couple cases early in March, but it really took a couple of months before cases started to escalate. And when that happens, it becomes more of a fear that you hear about, but you don't see. The thing that did impact people, though, was the economic impact from the shutdowns.
Yeah.
So suddenly business owners are struggling because they can't keep their business open. Meanwhile, they don't see the virus out in the wild. So I believe, this is just my opinion because I don't know, but I believe that had an impact on whether people were willing to follow mask mandates or social distancing.
Right.
It just wasn't really a real threat to actually most people until the holidays.
Yeah.
When cases really skyrocketed.
They really did. They really went up. Yeah, it seemed like it was also coming down from a lot of our leaders in a conservative county. A lot of our leaders, like LaMalfa and Gallagher and others, you know, they didn't wear masks. They kind of poo-pooed the virus, as our president had done. And so I think that also might have had an effect. But, you know, one of the things I wanted to remind our listeners that this is the Peace and Justice Program. We're talking today with Christian Hammond. He is a Chico native, and he is also the creator and curator of the unofficial Butte County COVID-19 dashboard. And if you're on Facebook, that's how I access it, but apparently also on Twitter, and you have a website too. And Christian, I heard on the Times today, or read in the Times, that they've just done a study published in Nature magazine where they looked at medical records of 73,000 people and found that the risks of death and chronic medical conditions are elevated in those not sick enough to be hospitalized. You know, this is post-COVID, so these long haulers, there's a lot we still don't know about COVID, and I'm hoping that today our listeners will, you know, if they've been hesitant about vaccines, that's the number one thing our conversation can do for our communities, and not just Butte, but all of our listeners here in the Northern Sacramento Valley, if they hear what we're talking about today, because this virus has really wreaked havoc. And the most shocking thing for me was looking at the 365-day graph that you have and about how the COVID rates climbed after about July 4th or so, and then kept ratcheting up after the election and Thanksgiving. And I was really appreciative that you put in these kind of relevant super spreader events to give reference to. But do you recall what your thoughts were as you were recording these rates? Did you feel like, you know, shouting from the rooftops? Did you feel like the power that you had as a faithful reporter was enough?
It never felt like enough.
Yeah.
I think by that point, I had about 4,000 people following the Facebook report and a pretty good amount of traffic all day long on the dashboard. But it never felt like enough. You know, hearing anecdotally about a person will go to the grocery store and see a bunch of people without masks on during all this, it was just like, how do you get through to people who don't see this as a threat?
Mm-hmm.
I remember thinking how, with the cases rising the way they were, like, you know, what is the ceiling? Like, how far is this going to really go before it comes back down? I think a lot of us expected the holidays were going to really ramp up the cases, but seeing like 150 cases in a day, you know, having to report every single day that somebody died, it does wear on you. And we're past the worst of it, hopefully. It was a lot. You know, there were days where I just felt kind of defeated at the end of it. Just seeing kind of where things were going. And it all comes down to, you know, people's individual behaviors. You know, it's all preventable. And I think that was the hardest thing, is just knowing we are choosing to allow the spread to happen.
Yes. Yes, and denial and misinformation. I'm not really sure what the misinformation sites were, but I ran into a number of people who are pushing very strong ideas that this is no worse than the flu and yada, yada, yada. So I know you just got your second shot of the Moderna vaccine. And what did you want to mention about your experience for those who may still be on the fence?
It was totally worth it. And it wasn't side effect free, but actually, I think it was the first like break I've had in like a few months. I got my second dose last Friday, so it's been 1 week now. I've got 1 week to go before I'm considered actually vaccinated. And pretty much, like, I got the vaccine later that evening. I felt, you know, kind of wiped out. A little bit of a sore arm, not too bad. Woke up the next morning and pretty much I was just like, okay, I've got a headache, but it's manageable. I feel like I need a couple of extra layers of blankets on me, but that's not so bad. and I just sat in front of the TV all day. Sunday morning, I woke up and I felt completely normal again.
Yeah.
Totally worth it. I would do it again.
Right. And I, as an older person, only had a sore arm. I didn't even have any response like what you went through for as a younger person.
That's great.
Yeah. You know, I want to go over this just real briefly, just to tell people what this mRNA vaccine is. What it does is the Moderna and the Pfizer, which are the ones that are available here in Butte County, these vaccines give instructions for our cells to make a harmless piece of what's called a spike protein. And you've seen the picture of the coronavirus. It looks like it has a throne with little spikes on it. Well, that's the spike protein. And it's found on the surface of the virus that causes the COVID. So when it's given into your upper arm muscle, the instructions, the mRNA, are inside the immune cells, and the cells use them to make the protein piece. After the protein piece is made, the cell breaks down the instructions and gets rid of them. Next, the cell displays the protein piece on its surface, and our immune systems recognize that the protein doesn't belong there and begins building an immune response and making antibodies like what happens in natural infection against COVID-19. And that's the place that Christian mentioned where he got the headache and he felt lethargic because his body was responding, his immune system was working. At the end of the process, our bodies have learned how to protect against future infection. The benefit of these mRNA vaccines, like all vaccines, is those vaccinated gain this protection without ever having to risk the serious consequences of getting sick with COVID-19, which isn't always 100% true. We have, you know, we've been finding that you can get mild to moderate COVID and even die from it, but it's a very, very extremely rare. Do you want to add anything to that, Christian?
I think also the fact that these vaccines can be so easily updated as new virus or variants come out. It's, for me, amazing. I almost think of it like software, in a way. If somebody discovers a new variant someplace in the world and they sequence it, they can email that code, that sequence, to a lab that can go work on extracting the spike protein. Mm. And they can email that to the manufacturers that are creating the new vials of the vaccine. And we've never been able to do that before.
Yes.
Or at least we've never done that on this kind of level before.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And the fact that these are so, yeah, the fact that they're so effective, too. Like, a flu vaccine is something like, what, 50, 60% efficacy? Okay. Kind of closer to a coin flip. It probably varies. But, like, these mRNA vaccines are talking 90, 95%.
That's wonderful. And they also appear to be working on the variants, the Pfizer and Moderna. So mm-hmm. we have less to worry about than what we feared even a month or two ago. I wanted to, you know, tell you that I lost a dear friend who was in a skilled nursing facility. She was an elder. And I think the most shocking part of this thing has been the casualties in skilled nursing facilities. And you have been recording everything, you know, that is important. And so have you compared Butte County rates in skilled nursing facilities to those from other parts of the state or the nation? And can you talk about that?
Sure. First, I'm really sorry about your friend.
Yeah.
I've been comparing the data a little bit. I'll briefly say working with data is really interesting, and we could talk about this for a while, but a lot of the data out there is not as comprehensive as you might think it is when you hear about all the data that's available. Things like skilled nursing facility data, you get some of the picture, but you don't get all of it. So you get a count on the number of patient cases, patient deaths, staff cases, staff deaths, but you have no idea how many people are actually at these facilities. Not every facility is tracked. And if any of those given numbers at any given facility is less than 11, it doesn't get reported. So it's just reported as one with a little note saying it's fewer than 11. Because of that, it's a little bit hard to compare, but I took a shot. So it looks like starting around around August of last year, we were kind of in line with the statewide rate in terms of cases and deaths. And then around the holidays, it massively shot up. The way I'm comparing it, which again, I don't have all the information, but the way I'm comparing it based on a number of cases relating to the population of the county, it seems that we actually ended up with more, like a higher percentage of people who developed COVID-19 in skilled nursing facilities than the state average. Deaths were about in the same ballpark, but cases were up, which I think is really interesting. What it, I kind of read from that, and it's a little bit of speculation, is that we were maybe not as careful with the holidays when it came to visiting loved ones in skilled nursing facilities. And to kind of really drill that home, prior to Thanksgiving, we had had 185 cases in skilled nursing facilities that were tracked and 9 deaths. So 185 and 9. A month after Christmas, we're at 606 cases. That's 421 new cases and 36 deaths. That's 27 new deaths. And that was driven by the holidays, which astounds me. Like, I was shocked when I looked at these numbers. That was very preventable.
Yeah. You know, I thought it was the workers, the underpaid workers who had to take public transportation and had to have multiple jobs. And, you know, I thought that's how coronavirus was getting into skilled nursing facilities. And I'm really so sorry for family members who have that guilt and weight of perhaps having been the one to expose grandma to the coronavirus that took her. That's rough.
It's really rough, yeah.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, there could be a mix of that. It could be a combination of people visiting loved ones, but also the workers bringing it in, not knowingly. COVID-19 is a very stealthy virus, or I should say SARS-CoV-2 is a very stealthy virus. You can have it and not even have any idea that you've got it, and you can spread it to people. And especially with these variants, it's really easy to do that. So why it was really important for people to get tested, why it's really important for people to get vaccinated.
Yeah. So we're talking to Christian Hammond here on the Peace and Justice Program. And Christian, I need to take just a short break, but please stay with me. Sure. We have to thank our underwriters because they're so important to the success of our station and keeping us healthy. So I want to thank all of the KZFR supporters and also Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op is open every day on the corner of 8th and Main Street in downtown Chico. Also, Chico Velo, supporting bicycling, education, and advocacy since 1980. The Wildflower returns this year on April 24th with a slightly different twist, a two-week-long extravaganza with three options to participate, special edition merchandise, and virtual interaction along the way. To join the Wildflower Adventure, visit wildflowercentury.org and on Facebook. Sounds like you better do it today. Also, I want to let you know that we're coming up on noon, and this is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Just want to thank a couple more underwriters here, and then we'll get back to Christian Hammond. I'd like to thank Regional and Continuing Education at Chico State, offering online graduate test preparation courses for those seeking an advanced degree in wide range of fields, including law and business. Sign up for a complimentary strategy session to help you to prepare to take the GRE, the GMAT, or the LSAT at rce.csuchico.edu. And lastly, I'd like to thank Sierra Nevada Brewing Company, family-owned, operated, and argued over since 1980, reminding listeners to think for themselves but drink with others. So we have a couple more minutes together, and, you know, during the early part of the pandemic, we were sewing masks. I was actually sending masks to the Yuba County Jail, and I was very focused on them because of immigrant detention that took place at Yuba Jail, and I wasn't paying any attention to the Butte County Jail, none at all. Mm-hmm. And but overall, in the country, apparently 9 people out of 100 have had COVID in the United States, but in prisons or jails, 34 out of 100 have had COVID. Can you give us any reflections about the Butte County Jail and what your findings indicated to you, Christian?
So I'm really appreciative that the jail has been providing updates throughout most of the past year, but it is a little bit hard to track kind of what's happened there. I have access to numbers about, like, you know, staff and inmate cases, and I have some information around testing. But actually seeing kind of what the conditions are at the jail, like, I have no information. But I will say that cases seem to be pretty aligned with skilled nursing facilities and with the general case rate in the county. But I believe that the reason that we've seen this virus really take hold in the jails is the same reason that we see it in skilled nursing facilities, and the same reason that we saw it last year in the cruise ships when people were stuck in port and basically locked in their rooms. This virus is an aerosolized virus. They're finding more and more now that not only does it hang out in the air, but it really hangs out in the air like smoke. If you can smell someone's cigarette from across the street, you can get the virus. And so when you're in a shared space where there isn't enough, like, air filtration and ventilation, it's really easy for this virus to go from one end of the place to the other and infect everybody along the way. So a jail is a really, you know, prime place for this virus to spread. And all it takes is getting into the facility, and you can start to have cases left and right.
Yeah.
They found the same thing with people that they put up in hotels for social distancing. This recent study that discusses the aerosolized nature of the virus was saying that hotels that are full of people who are trying to be socially distanced, some of these are homeless people that were put in the hotels in order to help them, like, avoid the virus. When one person's had it, it's made its way through the hotel, which was something that I just learned a few days ago.
That's scary.
And it's really scary. So this is, like, all the more reason for people to make sure that they are not having, like, parties indoors, for example.
Right. Yeah. Well, I want to get through some of the more information that you have. In August 28th of 2020, the state of California released the blueprint for a safer economy that would permit gradual reopening. And we are, and it's in tiers, T-I-E-Rs, and we're at the orange tier right now, which allows for 50% capacity. And I must say, I find it a little bit alarming to walk indoors to just, you know, what I would do is normally order and walk out. But now there's, you know, it seems like these places, that there's a lot of people in them now. So people need to understand how important all these statistics are. And I was wondering if you could, with the time we have left, really talk to us about what has been happening this week and even as recently as yesterday, because you put up this information daily, and about the new cases that you're seeing this week, and break it down by the county, because many of our listeners perhaps are not on Facebook, and some are not very internet savvy either, so they may not have ever come in contact with the information you're presenting.
Sure. So unfortunately, we're seeing cases go up. Now, we had that big spike around the holidays, and then in February it started to drop, and in March it dropped even further. But we're starting to see a return to February levels, on the way up. Hopefully not too far, but start the start of what looks to be like a mini surge. And so the past few days I've been reporting higher and higher numbers on a daily basis. Fortunately, I have not been reporting any new deaths. And when I say I'm not reporting, like the county's not reporting deaths, I'm just kind of relaying the numbers. So on the one hand, it's scary that we're going up, and that could even result in us going back up to the red tier. On the other hand, it seems like the vaccines are actually helping. We're just not seeing too many severe cases. But I'm really keeping an eye on the next 2 weeks, because if the trends that I'm seeing continue, then we could be at the point where we need to be like extra cautious again.
And meanwhile, we have 10 people hospitalized, 2 in the ICU, and I think 10 beds available in the county, ICU beds. So this remains in a small service area like this. It's important because there couldn't be any other kind of mass casualty when people tie up these beds with COVID, they're sick for a long time, mm-hmm. if they're ventilated.
Well, and on top of that, it's important to know that throughout most of the pandemic, we've been providing the hospital support for nearby counties.
Right.
So Glenn County, for example, we had a lot of their residents. And while at the moment it seems to be just Butte County people in the hospitals, like if cases start to ramp up all around us, we could see a situation where like the beds become almost unavailable again.
Right. So I heard that even pregnant women can get the vaccine, and now the vaccines are available to those 16 or older. The CSU system is going to require vaccination. There's still a lot of controversy about required vaccinations, but I'd like you to maybe tell us what we haven't talked about that you believe is important to cover from the data that you have uncovered just as recently as this week or yesterday.
A lot of it's going to be what I've kind of preached over the past year. People need to take personal responsibility here.
Mm-hmm.
This is not something that is under any government's control. This is under the community's control. Our own actions dictate what the virus does in the area. So that's the thing I just really want to stress is if you've got a family gathering, you should probably not go to it. If you are thinking about taking a trip someplace, maybe postpone it. The other thing is you talked about contact tracing earlier and how it kind of fell apart, and that seems to have been the problem kind of everywhere,
mm-hmm.
just with how many cases there are. Something that everyone can do that would really help is if you have a modern iPhone or Android phone, you want to look up and turn on mobile exposure notifications. This is a form of automated contact tracing, and I swear it's actually safe. It's very privacy conscious. It can't be used to track you. Mm-hmm. I've looked into this very closely. And it's a way that would allow people to know if they potentially have been in contact with somebody who has been exposed to COVID. Or rather has had a case of COVID. And this is probably going to be the future of contact tracing because it doesn't require a bunch of people to have to place a bunch of phone calls and for people to remember where they'd been. I have a whole article on that I occasionally post on my reports. But exposure notifications, turn it on.
So once again, is it called mobile exposure?
It's just exposure notifications.
Exposure notifications. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, listeners, this is really valid information. This may not even be our last pandemic. So, we've been on this huge learning curve, and some of us have learned our lessons, and some of us haven't. So, we're just all trying to pull one another along with information, and I just want to let our listeners know that I found so much information on 211buttecovid.org that has a hot topics area that has everything you need from food pantries, financial support, help coping with your stress, getting food supplies for your animals, you know, how information about the CARES Act, transportation assistance, delivery and pickup, volunteer information, and also, most importantly, the COVID-19 vaccine information, which is now appears to be taking place throughout the county and also at CVS, Rite Aid, Walgreens, Walmart, Save Mart. There are many, many places where you can get your vaccine, according to that page. Do you have more on that, Christian Hammond?
No, I don't really have much more on that. I think the county's done a pretty good job, though, of providing useful links for vaccine-related information. So I'm pretty much deferring to them on everything.
Yeah. And it appears that in the county, from your data, it looks like that Moderna, about 54% of people are using Moderna and 42% of the Pfizer, that more women than men are getting immunized, and I think what maybe is down a little bit is testing. And you were talking about earlier about how many of the COVID people with COVID have not been very symptomatic. I know people that have thought they had their allergies back, and it turned out they had COVID.
Right.
So what can you tell us about the importance of testing as people, there is this huge pandemic fatigue, and that's why I'm glad we're doing this now, because we have to hang in there, you know, until we're all safe. So tell us about testing a little more.
Testing is really important. It's no less important than it was before.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even any less important if you've been vaccinated. Testing is the only way we know if we have an increase in COVID cases. You know, if nobody tested, we wouldn't really know. And we might think, not testing will be in our best interest. Maybe we can go down a tier. But the reality is they factor in how much testing is happening within the county for tier calculations. So if people don't test, we won't know what the spread of the virus looks like. We won't know how much risk there is. We also won't be dropping down any tiers.
Right. And we won't be isolating. We won't be isolating those people. They'll be out and about.
Right.
spreading it. Oh, so in the last 2 minutes, Christian Hammond, again, I want to thank you for your contribution to your community up here in Butte County, and the labor of love that you've done is so appreciated. But do you have any last words for our listeners here on KZFR?
Just to everyone who's been following me, thank you so much for the support this past year. It's really helped me keep doing this. To everybody out in the community, just please do what you can to protect those around you, protect yourself, get tested, get vaccinated. Get vaccinated as quickly as you can, and we'll get past this if everyone does their part.
Yeah, and I wanted to add, Christian Hammond never monetized this site through this whole thing until last month when he let you buy him a cup of coffee. So if you're on Facebook,
strong-armed into it. Yeah,
you got strong-armed into it. Well, we appreciate it, and so this is online, just bc19.live, L-I-V-E. And do you want to tell us a little bit more about, you know, how to get there easily for Twitter and Facebook?
Sure. So definitely bookmark bc19.live, kind of like .com, but .live. On Twitter, you can find me at bc19live, no dot in there. On Facebook, you can search for unofficial Butte County COVID-19 dashboard, and you should find me. You'll have the icon with like a little red COVID with a little graph in the middle of it. And I do reports every single weekday on both of those, and the dashboard gets updated every day.
And, you know, on behalf of all the people that have gone through so much. You know, again, I want to thank you, Christian Hammond. Thank you for being with us here on the Peace and Justice Show, and thank you for your work in trying to keep us safe.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
So, listeners, this is Chris. The show is Peace and Justice. I would like to switch gears here and to talk to a local official next. I'm going to just put on a song that I was excited about this week, that the D.C. Statehood was went through the House of Representatives. And so I just wanted to play you this song, Give the People their right to Vote, from Sweet Honey and the Rock, from the Women Gather CD, because it's only fair to be represented in a democracy. And finally, maybe, D.C. will get the vote. Here we go.
No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote. Someone asked me, was it true? The voting rights of the district were long overdue. They couldn't believe it when I said yes. And then I said, you ain't heard nothing yet. We are based in Washington, D.C., a truly diverse community. Almost 600,000 strong have been exploited much too long. Inadequate power over our own affairs and national issues for which we care. No votes in Congress, the Senate, the House, no state delegation, no representation. We pledge allegiance, my country, 'tis a plea. Fighting wars, pay taxes in this country. Provide work and services for the government. We get no vote, but our money is spent well. You may wonder, how in the world can this be? I thought we lived in a democracy where the U.S. Constitution gives equal protection. Check the 14th Amendment to make this connection. No taxation without representation.
All right, you're going to celebrate with me. There's some good things going on. And I have on the line with me Alex Brown. She is a city council member here in Chico, and she's also a social worker. And she had a press conference the other day, and I just want to give my version of what led up to it briefly. Unhoused people have been sheltering in place in Chico public spaces, mostly riparian waterways and parks, during the COVID-19 pandemic. A conservative city council swept to power due to institutional support from the conservative state assemblymen and the relentless social media exploitation of improperly disposed discarded syringes and garbage. And in January, when they came in, they made good on their campaign promises and started to evict people from public spaces. And it has been relentless. It has been devastating to those who have been moved. It's caused a lot of distress for campers. Finally, right before, within 24 hours of eviction of the last and largest camp on Comanche Creek, there was a temporary restraining order filed by Legal Services of Northern California. And Alex Brown is part of the minority with Scott Huber on the Chico City Council. And she had a press conference the other day, and it was disrupted, very difficult to listen to, even though incredibly important information was being shared there. And so I would like you, Alex Brown, to please tell us what you tried to tell us at your April 20th press conference about the shelter crisis declaration, which obviously is very important. You know, why is the shelter crisis declaration important, and what do you propose? And I didn't give that background, but basically Councilmember Denley announced that there was no shelter crisis and therefore no need to work on any shelter solutions. So please go ahead, Alex Brown. Thank you for being with us tonight, today.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me and for that that helpful overview. I think you really touched on all the main points here. And you know, just to be clear, that the press conference on Tuesday was organized by myself and Councilmember Scott Huber, who has, you know, been the other voice on the council really looking at solutions to this growing crisis. And after that Tuesday meeting, right, and I want to give a little bit of context, because what happened on Tuesday is actually critically important to what is going on now. Not this Tuesday, the previous council meeting. What was on the agenda was a request by myself and supported by Councilmember Huber to establish a safe, regulated, legal campground or pallet sheltering environment at the on 4/5 of an acre property at the BMX site. That site had previously been rejected because of the BMX organization operating on it. But new information came forward showing that that 4/5 of an acre was a viable opportunity. So council approved that to be agendized. And at that Tuesday meeting in early April, when that conversation came forward, sorry if you hear dogs barking in the background, when that conversation came forward, that was what we were supposed to be talking about, right? Establishing this land or not.
Right.
What ended up happening was I made a motion to, you know, pretty clear motion directing staff to start moving forward and identifying a service provider and kind of the steps that needed to be taken in order for that site to be operable. Councilmember Denley made a substitute motion, not only rejecting the BMX property as a whole as an opportunity for sheltering, but, you know, making a statement about homeless people, saying that the people on our streets do not want shelter and therefore we don't have a shelter crisis because the beds that are available, they simply don't want, right? And so kind of whittling the issue down to that level. Well, after that, you know, this all came to a head with the temporary restraining order, which was granted by a judge as it relates to the Martin versus Boise case. And Councilmember Huber and myself decided we really needed to address the public. There was a lot of data being shared by some of my colleagues on council that had been really, in my opinion, misinterpreted and or misrepresented to the public about what the current state of sheltering in our community is, particularly emergency sheltering, because as you and I know, not all shelters, not all housing, not all permanent supportive housing is created equal. It all comes with varying levels of barriers, ability to pay, and accessibility issues for folks. And so we went through that data, consulted with the COC, consulted with the county to really get a much better picture of what the current state of sheltering and emergency shelter in Chico is so that we could present that to the public. And also to genuinely address the severe impacts that rescinding the shelter crisis declaration would have on our community. That vote that was taken by council to rescind the shelter crisis declaration under the interpretation that we simply don't have a shelter crisis at all and therefore don't need any more shelter beds has a lot of domino effects, one of those being the loss of almost $850,000 of existing awarded funding, right? This isn't funding that people are currently applying for. It's already been awarded to nonprofits operating in the city of Chico and in Butte County. That money would go away if the shelter crisis declaration is rescinded. Not only would that happen, you know, and place significant strains on our local nonprofits who are working to actually address the issue of homelessness with evidence-based solutions, but it would also restrict our access to potential future funding to confront this problem. So it was really a double whammy at that meeting, and it felt pretty critically important to address the public and give good data, get a good analysis of the data, and consult with experts so that they could give some context.
Yeah, I'm For me, it's very upsetting, and I understand that from what the group Stand Up for Chico has said, that Council Member Denley's motion was made in violation of the Brown Act, that the motion wasn't agendized, there was no opportunity for public comment. How do you propose that people in Chico respond to this?
It's unfortunate, right? And I think it's become a pattern with this particular council to try to slide things in under the radar. And this was a huge one, right? For such consequential decisions, there's a process that we go through where we agendize the item by vote of the council. A council member is required to submit documentation to kind of explain their argument and what they're asking of council. The public should have access to that with public noticing through the agenda packet, and then have an opportunity for public comment on that item. So I understand the outcry and the response to this as a, you know, because at the very least, it demonstrates a sincere lack of transparency with the public on things that directly impact our entire community. I get it. I get why people are upset. I get why they're exercising their rights to hold their leaders accountable for that transparency. And I think it was shocking. It was surprising. Yes and no. It was shocking and surprising, right? There had been a press conference held by Mayor Coolidge and Vice Mayor Reynolds at least a week, if not more, earlier, where they were using that data that Councilmember Huber and I overviewed at our press conference to indicate that there's not a shelter crisis. And so what happened later was, you know, rescinding the declaration. So I think we could have probably seen it coming. But, you know, my expectation is that we're agendizing those items. There's documentation. The public has an opportunity to respond, and they can really take part in their democracy in that way. And that just didn't happen this time.
Yeah, and I just want to mention, in terms of democracy, you know, these meetings had been on Zoom, and you could respond in that way. But in this last week, unmasked people who called themselves patriots with American flags pretty much took over the meeting and closed it down. Mm-hmm. And now there'll be another Zoom meeting on Monday where I assume people can weigh in. But then after mm-hmm. that, the chambers are going to be at 50% capacity. And as we were just talking about the COVID crisis, the crisis really isn't over, despite people's boredom and fatigue with the crisis. It's still there. So it makes it extremely hard for those of us who are, you know, worried about this funding and about unhoused people to really be able to step up and be involved. And so I don't know what you have to suggest about that, but if you have any ideas about how can we be powerful in a place of of where we're not able to get our words in.
So I can understand just the feeling of being disempowered, but I also want to just quickly note how much power I'm seeing in our community mm-hmm. in response to some of these tragedies that we're seeing, right? These encampment sweeps, telling people they can't be here, but they have nowhere to go. I have seen such a show of solidarity and activism on the part of our community to demand better. And here's what I think. I think sometimes these things come to a head, right? People voted in this council on the promise of, you know, making abject poverty less visible. And I don't know that they fully understood what that looks like and what that means until now, seeing it in action. And so I really do think people are waking up to the realities of that. And, you know, clearly our legal system has protections in place for folks as well. And so we're really seeing all of that play out and come to a head. And I'm not happy to see that kind of human suffering, as I think none of us are. But I think it's also really critically important that we understand we can't just sweep this under the rug. So I guess all that is to say, keep using your voices. Keep showing up to these rallies. Keep writing your city council emails. And if you can, if you feel comfortable coming and speaking during business from the floor, at council meetings, either in person or via Zoom, as long as that's an accessible option, to really make it known where you stand. I get dozens and dozens of emails every single week from folks who want to see us doing better and approaching this issue better. And I think that's the kind of pressure that the public really needs to apply to make sure that if enforcement is a priority, well, then we dang sure better be also ensuring that people have a place to go that's safe, that's accessible, and that's reasonable.
Yeah. And Alex Brown, we sure appreciate everything that you've done and tried to do, being a voice of reason on the city council. And just want to let our listeners know that the hearing was this morning on the temporary restraining order, and the judge decided, Judge England, that both parties were to work on this TRO, temporary restraining order, and it's been extended for 3 weeks, and so the case isn't over, that both sides have issues to address. And so you as a city council person are going to be very busy. But I just hope we the people will get our voices heard. There will be peaceful protests for human rights Monday the 26th at 5 p.m. In front of the city council chamber. So if people want to show up to that, they can. And last words? Any last words, Alex?
Oh, yeah. I do just have a quick note I want to make. You know, I think public engagement is critical, right? Especially when it comes to issues like what we're taking on right now in chambers. But I think it's also really critically important because what you just said, Chris, that this pandemic isn't over. When we say masks are required in chambers, that we as leaders take accountability for that, so that those folks who don't want to be exposed but do want to participate in their democracy know that it's going to be safe to do so in person. And so I just want to encourage folks to kind of hold leaders accountable for making sure that our rules are followed as well, and that we set a good standard. Most communities are not open to the public right now. And so we're going to be among the first to do this. And I think it's important that we're willing to respond if folks don't respect those rules and respect the public health of people around them.
Thank you, Alex Brown, for your work. And we're really following everything you're doing with appreciation.
Thank you so much. It's good to be here. Take good care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, so our final segment of the Peace and Justice program for today is a pre-recorded interview. It was Earth Day yesterday. The most important thing that we have, besides the earth and the air, is the water. And our water is really under threat. And there is a group that's called, a nonprofit that's called Aqua Alliance, that exists to defend Northern California waters against the challenge and threats to the hydrologic health of North Sacramento River watershed. And I plucked an interview that Bill Mash did on his North State Water Report segment. The interview is Ron Topi, and the person that is being interviewed is Jim Brobeck, who is the water policy analyst for Aqua Alliance. And I'd like to go straight to that interview so that we have time to complete it before the end of the show. Here you go.
Next up on Imagining Community is the premiere of the North State Water Report with Jim Brobeck and Ron Topi. Jim is a watershed policy analyst with AquaAlliance.net, and Ron is a board member at runforsalmon.org. The topic this month is Sites Reservoir, a proposed $5.2 billion off-stream reservoir project west of Colusa in the Sacramento Valley of Northern California. The project would pump 470,000 to 640,000 acre-feet per year of the winter flood flow from the Sacramento River upstream of the Sacramento-San Joaquin River Delta through existing canals to an artificial lake 14 miles away.
I have with me Jim Brobeck, who is a water policy analyst with the Aqua Alliance. We're going to discuss, just what's going on with Sites Reservoir. And Jim told me that there's some big news happening right now, too, with that. So what's the scoop, Jim?
The proponents of Sites Reservoir are composing another draft environmental impact report. The previous one they did in 2017 has been abandoned, so all the work that people put in making comments on the previous draft environmental impact report have been thrown in the trash can. They never did respond to it. They decided to downsize the project, but the main parameters of the project remain and the problems associated with it remain. So it's undergoing a process right now, and they're trying to hold some so-called small group meetings with people who have commented in the past. So sometime early next month, I will be part of a small group looking at water quality issues in Sites Reservoir.
What are they actually trying to do with Sites? Where is it, and what's the end goal? Like, what are they looking to do?
Sites Reservoir would be located just to the west of Maxwell, California. The Coast Range over there has a series of ridges before it climbs into the mountains in the Mendocino Forest. And these ridges run parallel to the Coast Range, and they plan to install several dams over there where a couple of the creeks that flow out of the Coast Range come out, and then pump water out of the Sacramento River during high flow events into Sites Reservoir, and then to be able to use that water later. That's an off-stream reservoir, so that ameliorates some of the concerns of river and fish advocates that don't want to see any more dams right on the main stem of any of these main rivers. So they would be taking water off of the river and putting it into what they call an off-stream storage facility. Of course, they've been looking at this project for about 50 years now. It's never penciled out. It's not economically or environmentally feasible. So I have concerns that millions of dollars of taxpayer money continues to flow into the planning, into the consultants that are looking at it, and into the management committee that runs the thing. But nonetheless, it remains a threat to the hydrology of Northern California. So Aqua Alliance and other groups are looking closely at it and watching as it unfolds. My primary concerns has to do with water quality.
So you said they want to install more dams on some of the smaller creeks and send out water to a storage facility. So that storage facility would just essentially be in a big open reservoir?
It would be an open reservoir. And one of the main problems with these big infrastructure projects is it increases expectations from people that live in the drier parts of the state for a reliable water source. If they're going to put the money in, they're going to demand that they get the water out. And we see that happening every year in California with the overallocation of the contracts of junior water rights holders that are on either the State Water Project, which comes out of the Oroville Reservoir primarily, or the Federal Water Project that comes out of Shasta Reservoir. And these expectations of water deliveries allow them to push in the media a story that their water allocations are not being fulfilled, and that environmentalists and Congress that are under the thumb of environmentalists are preventing them from getting their rightful water deliveries. Of course, all these junior water rights holders know that their water deliveries are based on surplus water availability, and there never is the amount of surplus water availability that they expect that are in the contract. So every year they can claim they're not getting their due share. And on a year like this, this 2020-21 water year, this has been an extraordinarily dry year in both parts of the state. So the northern part of the Central Valley and the southern part of the Central Valley have had much less water than what is considered to be normal.
Describe who would be considered a major water allocation as opposed to a minor.
Well, the United States Bureau of Reclamation has recently released the numbers. They said that the junior water rights holders on their arm of the water delivery system in California are only scheduled to receive 5% of their total allocation. So it's a matter of percentages of millions of acre feet of water, an acre foot of water being the amount of water it would take to flood a space approximately the size of a football field with a foot of water. And we're talking about millions of acre feet of water that the water purveyors expect to be delivered mostly through the Delta and into canals that go into the southern part of the San Joaquin Valley. And so this year, with only 5% allocation, and on top of that, just yesterday, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation explained that they don't even think they're going to be able to deliver this 5%, that the water shortage is so extreme this year that they think the 5%, there's not water there to even deliver that modest amount of water. So the big agriculture interests in the San Joaquin Valley are really stressed out right now because they think they're not going to be getting their surface water allocation.
So a junior water rights user would be your farmers, or?
Most of them are farmers. Some municipalities are junior water rights holders. The senior water rights holders are people who developed taking water out of the river systems prior to the building of the big dams. So these are called settlement contractors. And they are allowed to take a certain amount of water off of the river every year as part of the settlement. And they're the senior water rights holders. They're the ones that hold rights to the most amount of water, and they're first in line to get the water. They're also the people that are in a position to sell their surface water allocation. And they don't ever sell their surface water rights. They hold on to that like a pot of gold. But they will occasionally sell that year's allocation and either fallow land, take it out of production that year, or pump groundwater in what's called groundwater substitution to continue growing the crop while they sell their surface water allocation.
You're listening to the North State Water Report with Ron Topi and Jim Brobeck here on KZFR 90.1 FM.
And that is one of the biggest threats to the hydrologic balance of the northern Sacramento Valley is these groundwater substitution water transfers.
So are some of these senior water rights holders, are they big water districts or are they mostly big agricultural companies?
They're organized around the big water districts. And they can be individual farmers that are part of the district that can sell their water allocation and either fallow or pump groundwater. Or the district as a whole can do it.
Let's back up a little bit, and you were saying how they want to dam some of the smaller creeks and send this water into Sites Reservoir for storage. Do these creeks run into the Sacramento River?
They do, and what's really important to recognize is the Coast Range, both in northern and southern Central Valley, is heavily laden with minerals that are soluble, so that when you get precipitation on the eastern slope of the Coast Range, it leaches these heavy minerals and heavy metals and salts into the creeks. Now, there's not a whole lot of water that comes out of the east side of the Coast Range, so that water tends to be diluted by the enormous flows that are coming out of the Sierra and the Cascade. But when there are flood events, what happens in the northern Sacramento Valley is they hold the water back in back of Shasta Reservoir and back of Shasta Dam. And so the water that's flowing down the Sacramento during those periods, a lot of it, especially north of Red Bluff, is coming out of the Cottonwood Creek drainage, which is a Coast Range water drainage. Most of the water would probably be coming out of the Cottonwood Creek drainage. And the Cottonwood Creek drainage, as well as the small streams that flow into the proposed footprint of Sites Reservoir, all have highly elevated levels of heavy metals and salts during these precipitation events. So according to Jerry Bowles, who is a retired director of environmental health and in the Northern District of DWR. He retired maybe 10 years ago. According to him, the source water for Sites Reservoir, which would be coming out of the Cottonwood Creek drainage, would have excessive levels of these heavy metals in it. So the water right from the beginning that would be pumped into the Sites Reservoir would have levels of these heavy metals that are out of compliance with state water regulations, water that would usually be diluted by the other flows coming out of Shasta. And then once it's put into the Sites Reservoir footprint, a footprint that contains salt mines, it contains a salt lake, it contains these deposits in it, it would exacerbate the amount of heavy metals that are in the source waters, because it would be leaching it out of the footprint of Sites Reservoir. And if you've ever seen the edges of Shasta Reservoir and Oroville Reservoir, when the water's low, you'll see the entire perimeter of these reservoirs that have highly fluctuating levels is a dead zone, is a sacrifice zone that has no vegetation left, no roots left to control the erosion. So once you drain these reservoirs down, as they would be draining Sites Reservoir, you'd have this naked dirt that when the rain did come back, it would be eroding gullies at a much higher level than it currently is. Because right now there are blue oaks over there and there's grasslands and other native plants that hold the soil in place. And so the amount of heavy metals that would be leaching into the reservoir from the runoff along the naked edges would further increase the heavy metal load in Sites Reservoir. And on top of that, since it would be a shallow reservoir located over on the east side of the Sacramento Valley, where there is often strong northeast winds that are highly evaporating winds, you would have what's called evaporative enrichment of these toxic materials that are melted into the water that would be stored in Sites Reservoir. So what you would end up with is water that would be literally illegal to put back into the Sacramento River to support fisheries, according to the state of California anti-degradation policy that disallows putting water into the river that would degrade the water quality in the river for beneficial uses.
And is that how they would deliver the water to water users, is by pumping it back into the Sacramento River?
That's what they claim they would be doing. But it appears to me that Northern California would be stuck with this heavy metal-laden, salty water that up here we would have to use it for some purpose, leaving other water in the river to be shipped south or to flush through the delta. So my concern is one of the toxic materials is arsenic. Arsenic is a material that rice takes up into the plant. And if they use this water to irrigate rice fields in the northern Sacramento Valley, it would obviously decrease the value of that rice for human consumption, if not make it unhealthy to eat. So my concern is that it would just degrade the water quality, degrade the soils, and lead to a degradation of the soils on the west side of the Sacramento River, much like we're seeing on the west side of the San Joaquin Valley, where the ground is becoming salty and laden with toxic materials like selenium, because the land down there never should have been irrigated in the first place because of the existence of these naturally occurring minerals.
So is any of this a result of the gold mining days?
That's not the issue that I'm focused on. I'm focused on, and others like Mr. Bowles, the retired DWR specialist, is focused on the naturally occurring minerals. And there are other sources of toxic materials that come into the river. But even without those, the naturally occurring minerals pose a hazard if it's managed in this way.
You're listening to the North State Water Report with Ron Topi and Jim Brobeck here on KZFR 90.1 FM.
So essentially what would happen is these water-soluble minerals would leach into the soil and wouldn't stay suspended in the water, and then when you add more water, it would concentrate all of those minerals?
Well, it naturally exists in the soil profile itself, and as water flows through it and over it, amounts of it do end up in the water that flows out through the streams on the other side. But if you denude the land, it will only increase the amount of erosion and the amount of these minerals that would end up in the water. And it would be particularly high levels in the site's reservoir if they do denude the hillsides over there in the same way that they've denuded the hillsides surrounding the Feather River in the footprint of the Oroville Reservoir, or the Pitt River, the McLeod River, and the Sacramento River up in the Shasta Reservoir. This is one of the reasons why I'm so strongly opposed to the raising of Shasta Dam. Every time you raise the level of the water a foot, it, around the entire perimeter of the reservoir, it kills the edges that are flooded. And if they want to raise it 12 feet, you would have tens of thousands of acres that would be sacrificed, that would be have their trees taken out on what are right now beautiful riparian zones, such as what exists up there in the Winnemem Wind II sacred sites. They say, well, it's just a quarter mile of stream. Well, a quarter mile with maybe 20 feet or 50 feet of surface on each side of the stream would then turn into a wasteland, a sacrifice zone. It's unacceptable.
Yeah, being on the board of directors of the ICO, the Indian Cultural Organization, which is a nonprofit that the Winnemem Wind II have set up for the Office of Cultural Preservation, the raising of Shasta Dam will flood a couple of their remaining sacred sites along the McLeod River.
It would temporarily flood it, but then it would be the first part that got drained as well. It would be at the top of the reservoir. So it would probably be permanently dry and denuded of any vegetation.
Yeah, it would be part of that big, kind of like you described, it looks like a big toilet bowl ring around the
That's an
around
excellent
the land
metaphor.
When it goes down.
And these zones are not toilets. These zones are sacred lands, not
right,
toilets.
Right. So as far as Sites Reservoir goes and how people can stay informed with what's happening, are there meetings that people could listen in on or attend and actually have their public comments heard?
Eventually they will be holding public meetings once they release the draft environmental impact report. But since I participated in the past, they've invited myself and some of my colleagues to take part in these, they're calling them small group meetings. They're not being advertised as public meetings. They're going to be internet-based remote meetings. So there's one coming up in a week or so having to do with when and where they're going to take the water out of the river. And then another one later in April to talk about water quality issues. And I'm hoping that they're honest in fulfilling our expectation that we will have an honest dialogue. I'm skeptical on it. I'm skeptical that these consultants are really willing to listen to our concerns. And with that in mind, some organizations are willing to take this to court to press the issue and to make sure there's real public review of these things. It's important for me to take part in the planning process and not just sit back and wait for the lawsuit. I'm willing to flex legal efforts when it comes down to it, but I think it's important in good faith to take part in the planning processes of water policy here in California, and that's why I'm so active in the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act process in my area, as well as environmental review of some of these big projects. Ron, I see great threats and great opportunities here. The threat is that politicians on both sides of the aisle are supporting water projects that are targeting the northern Sacramento Valley to supply water to not just the municipalities, which tend to do a pretty good job on conservation, but also to the agricultural interests south of the Delta. Keep in mind, 80% of the developed water in California goes to agriculture. Less than 20% goes to the 30 million people that rely on imported water. These are our allies, these citizens that are doing noble efforts to conserve water in the urban environment. It is the unfettered expansion of irrigated agriculture by investor-owned agriculture interests, especially in the southern part of the Central Valley, that is driving this demand for new water infrastructure. And it's both Democrat and Republican politicians that are supporting these wasteful and unrealistic and unfeasible water projects. But it is the 98% of the citizens in Northern California who are not holding senior water rights, who are in no position to profit from the water market, that should be unifying and understanding that we need to resist the dewatering of the Northern Sacramento Valley, in spite of what our elected politicians on both sides of the aisle are pushing. This is an opportunity for the vast majority of the citizens that live in Northern California to come together to defend not just the surface water, but the groundwater. The groundwater is the foundation of the hydrologic health in Northern California, of the valley. It is the buffer that helps us to endure these long periods of dry if we don't extract too much of it as a backstop to supply the demand that the rest of the state is expecting from up here. In order for the state to have a sustainable source of water, we need to preserve the hydrologic balance of the Sacramento Valley. And this will allow the people of California to have a sustainable water supply. If we decide to integrate the groundwater of the Sacramento Valley into the state water supply, this will eliminate the final buffer we have from drought and further dewater the streams, the rivers that the rest of the state relies upon to supplement their water source. So once people can rise above their political affiliations and recognize the common interest that we all have in conserving the water of the Northern Sacramento Valley, the stronger we will be and the stronger the whole state will be. So I see it as a great opportunity, and I'm reaching out to my fellow citizens of Northern California, regardless of their political affiliation, to recognize that conservation is the first step in a sensible water policy for the state of California.
Thank you so much, Jim Brobeck, with all the work that you do on Aqua Alliance and taking some time today to talk to us about Sites Reservoir and the big concerns over North State Water. As an activist and organizer with Run for Salmon, I think we also need to not just speak of the concerns of people, but of the salmon and the other creatures that depend on healthy water in the North State. And specifically, restoring healthy salmon runs, as salmon are a keystone species as far as the quality of the water within the North State.
Ron, you know the metaphor canary in a coal mine?
Yes.
Well, I would like to be able to shift that to salmon in the streams.
Right.
The salmon in the streams are the indicator, in the same way that the canary in the coal mine was the indicator.
I love that, Jimmy. The salmon in the streams. There it is.
You just heard the premiere of the North State Water Report with Jim Brobeck and Ron Topi, airing first Thursdays at 6:30 p.m. on Imagining Community. Until the next time, always remember, if you have a roof, be grateful.
And you are tuned to listener-supported community radio, 9.1 KGFR Chico. We want to thank Quicksilver Courier Service, established in 2010. Quicksilver Courier Service has the flexibility to provide a broad range of services. Quicksilver provides courier service for private individuals as well as legal, medical, and business professionals. Visit ChicoCourier.com for 24/7 service details. And by Patrick Riley, a real estate professional with the Hightower Group, specializing in properties in Chico and Butte Meadows. Patrick is dedicated to helping buyers and sellers achieve their real estate goals with compassionate quality service. Patrick can be reached at 588-6593 and on Facebook. Just about 12 o'clock, or 1 o'clock rather, so let's do the community calendar, and then we'll be right back with Playing Dead. Thanks for tuning in.
Hey, listeners, it's time for the KZFR 90.1 FM community calendar with me, Megan Hammer. Help Paradise and show a little